this Aiden with Oddball Pilot down in Las Vegas. I was down here to actually go to a woofer course. And when I was coming down, I contacted a friend of mine, Jeremy Ellison. We guided together for a number of years. Did my second China trip together. And while we were in China, we talked a lot about Jeremy's interest in flying helicopters. And since then, he's gone ahead and gotten through his commercial instrument, got sort of that initial job, which is the hardest one to get, and more recently has got a job flying here in Vegas for one of the flight seeing outfits in A-Star. So in my mind, that's kind of, he's kind of made it. There's certainly jobs beyond this one that he might be interested in, but he's gotten to the point where you don't really get better equipment than an A-Star. So in the helicopter world, he's, as long as he keeps his nose clean, he's probably there. So joining us for this discussion is my friend Dylan Taylor, who you might remember from the Afghanistan trip. And Dylan is a paraglider pilot and wrote the recent article about flying in Antarctica. And we're just going to talk to Jeremy about kind of his path getting to this point and how the struggle to get to this point, how he made it succeed, and kind of any ideas or tips that he might have for someone else starting down this wayward path. So, Dylan, feel free to sort of pop in whenever you've got a pertinent question. And Dylan's flown in helicopters for his guiding work, both in Antarctica and in Chamonix. So he's actually got a lot of good, interesting experience relating to helicopters. And he's been interested in flying since I've known him as well. So, Jeremy, when did you first think you wanted to fly helicopters?
My first exposure to helicopters was working in the U.S. Antarctic program. And up until that point, it's probably, I guess, 99, 2000. It was my first time I went to Antarctica. Worked there as a carpenter, and we flew to work in A-Stars for PHI, the contract down there, and took us out to our field camps. And up until that point, I'd never even thought about really flying a helicopter. I mean, I'd seen them in, like, ski movies and thought they were cool, but I'd never been in one because they were so expensive. And it was the first time I'd ever set foot in one. I was like, this is a pretty amazing machine and taking me to these really cool places, and he's dropping me off to dig a hole, and he's flying to some other cool place, you know. So I was thinking that his job might be a little better than mine, you know.
Yeah, but your carpentry job was pretty good too.
It was a good job, yeah. I was working in the field. I got to build boxes and sleds and fly to places that not a lot of people get to see and camp out, and you know, the dry valleys are pretty amazing, and a lot of the things that I was seeing were, yeah, I was enjoying myself for sure.
But you just thought the helicopters might be more fun or different.
Yeah. You get the super expensive, complicated machine that takes you to these amazing places, and, you know, he's wearing like a Hawaiian shirt and, instead of a down parka, and you know, he's got stories about flying on oil rigs in Africa, and, you know, and he's landing on icebergs and flying, you know, in the mountains, and had a pretty big love for the mountains, and I was like, that could be a pretty good next step.
So how is this? So from the first inkling that you might want to fly them, how long did it take to actually take that first lesson?
Well, at the time I was mountain guiding as well, and so I was spending part of my time working in Antarctica. It was 6 seasons there, and I would come home and mountain guide, kind of supporting myself by mostly working as a carpenter, and then you know, the limited money that I made guiding as well. And so for me, the big step was the financial stuff, because coming, you know, after I kind of was exposed to it and spent some seasons flying it, I thought it was something I might like. I went and, like a lot of people, I took a intro flight, and, you know, you spend $100 and you go out for half an hour and they give you the controls pretty quickly and you kind of see what it's like. They do an auto rotation.
Get the hover down like that.
No, yeah, it's pretty quick, you know, they have dual controls in there, and within a few minutes, you're, you know, operating some part of the helicopter, and you're like, wow, this is pretty challenging and, like, pretty fun. And but then the reality of how much it costs hits pretty quick, and I didn't have a lot of money, you know. I had been buying and selling houses for a number of years, like, you know, with the money that I'd saved from Antarctica, I was using my carpentry skills to buy houses and then fix them up and then sell them. And so I had some property in Leavenworth, and I owned a house that I had kind of worked towards for a decade or so, and that was really my only money. I had about $100,000 in equity in properties, and I didn't really couldn't really afford it. You know, I mean, you're
right.
The reality of how much it cost to fly was, and the loans that were available were terrible. I mean, super high interest. You know, there because it's not a, you know, it's not a furthering or continuing
education.
Yeah, it's a high interest loan. You're not getting student loans to go fly a helicopter. You're getting like a 10% loan for, you know, and if you're borrowing $70,000 or $80,000 at 10%, and you're going to get out as a CFI and make maybe $20,000 a year if you're lucky. So.
Did you think about? I know I talked to you in China, and I've always thought this was probably the better way to go. But you would get the better insight than I would. Get your fixed wing and do the helicopter as an add-on.
There's a lot of talk of that to save money, but in my experience, unless you want to fly both at some point down the road, which is a feasible thing, like the company I work for now, they have a caravan. They like dual-rated pilots because they want people to be able to fly both their aircraft, and that's a possibility if that's your goal. But if your goal is to just fly helicopters, my opinion is that it's better for you to just fly helicopters. It is cheaper, and some of the hours do count towards, like if you're getting a private and you wanted to do a portion of those in a Cessna because it's half as much money, you can get to the same place, but it doesn't, in order to build hours as a helicopter pilot, your first job is almost always as a CFI. I mean, 95% of the people or something, unless they had some other, you know, family or something that could get them a job or whatever, you know, or some exception to the rule, they're going to be a CFI. And they want you to have all your time in the helicopter, in a Robinson specifically.
Because you only have 300 hours anyways.
And there's some rules that require you to have a certain amount of hours in that specific aircraft, because, like, especially an R-22 and R-44. And you only finish school with a couple hundred hours anyway, and they really want all of those hours in that aircraft. And if you spent half of it in an airplane, you would be a disadvantage to other people who had done it all in the helicopter. And that's really competitive. Like for, you know, my school was like probably graduating. I mean, they probably had 50 students at a time, 45, 50 students at a time. A big portion of those aren't finishing all the way through and aren't getting all the way to CFI or running out of money. Maybe half of those people are completing ratings. And then of those, you know, so many are finishing a CFI and a II and right. Getting to the point, you know, you might get 15 out of the 50 who actually finished to the point where they could get a job, and then of those 15, two got hired.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's super competitive and really hard to get those jobs, so you would be at a disadvantage to do half your time in a plane, even though it's cheaper. In the end, you wouldn't have as much time or as much skills.
So in the end, yes, you'd have your helicopter, you'd actually get your commercial instrument helicopter CFI
cheaper,
for less money. However, you're then going to have to get 50 more hours in a helicopter to catch up with the people who just the helicopter.
It just depends, yeah. I mean, there are people who've done that, and it has worked. It could work. And if your goal was to be dual rated and fly both, which is some people's goal.
Right.
And I work with people now that do that, and they love flying the airplane, and that's something that works really well for them. If that's what you want to do, then that's great. But if your goal is just to become a helicopter pilot, it's not an advantage.
I think.
You're going to save a little bit of money, but it's not an advantage.
I'm going to throw this in for dual-rated pilots. Until you've got a significant amount of time in both rotorcraft and fixed wing, it can be hard to switch back and forth. Mm-hmm. And if you're primarily a fixed wing guy and you're going to fly a helicopter 100 hours a year, I think there are good arguments that you're not a particularly safe helicopter pilot. Because your hand-eye skills aren't. They're fixed wing related, and I've talked to a guy who flies up in Alaska, and he was hired to fly both, and they ended up just making him a helicopter guy. They said, "We want you to be good in the helicopter. We're going to get you out of the fixed wing stuff and just concentrate on your flying the helicopter." And it's worked out really well for him. And some of their guys do dual rating, dual duty, but most of them are really high time fixed wing guys, and so the fixed wing stuff they don't have to think about much at all. And the helicopter, they can concentrate on learning that every time they fly it.
I think when you're like working, first starting off as a CFI and you have 200 hours, most people really need all of that time to be even close to what would be considered competent and safe to do that job. And, like, in my opinion, it's probably a stretch to say that they are even then. So doing less, doing half of that time in an airplane would not be doing yourself a favor just for your own safety or the safety of the person that you're teaching. I mean, it's the U.S. is the only place that allows people at 200 hours to teach other people how to fly helicopters, and it really just comes down to money. Like in Canada, it doesn't happen at all. They wouldn't even consider it. Like, it's, you know, not possible.
Right.
Because you have a brand new person who's barely competent himself teaching someone else. And it only comes down to money. And that's why everyone comes here to do their helicopter ratings and licenses, because they're cheap. It's cheaper. It's much cheaper. It's a fraction of the cost of anywhere else. It's double in Canada what it costs in the U.S.
It is funny. I was talking to someone recently about it. Might have been Paul, actually. They still couldn't get their head wrapped around the idea that your first job as a, you know, pilot being paid is a CFI, or is often a CFI. Okay. And it's like, you've just barely learned this stuff, and you're teaching someone. And there's some advantages to that, too.
And you're doing emergency procedures. You're doing things that are putting you at risk. You're
absolutely
doing things that are far more risky than going out and flying tours like what I'm doing right now. Like, I don't do emergency procedures all day. I pick the helicopter up. I fly it from point A to point B. There's one approach, one landing, a start, and I'm not shutting the engine off and doing an auto and doing a run on landing and doing all kinds of things.
And not only that, but letting someone who doesn't know how to do it do it.
Touch the controls. And so you're putting yourself at risk at a real low hour, you know, and there's a lot of accidents in training.
There are.
And that's for that reason.
let's back off that. You didn't instruct. You got your CFI.
Yeah. I'm one of the small percentage, right? So I finished all those ratings because they said, oh, you have to do that, and everyone, that's how you get your job. And then
true.
You have to have your CFII, and you know, I've watched all these people, and that was the truth for sure. So I finished mine. I was one of the, you know, 15 or whatever. I think it was like 15, 16 people that finished at the same time as me, got their II. Like, just like I said, they hired a few people.
Yeah.
We all got interviews. I didn't get hired right away. At that point, I had spent almost all my money. I spent about $80,000 plus living expenses and being off work. And, you know, I needed a job. And I needed it to work. And even if it was a low-paying job, I needed to continue. The main thing is I needed to continue to fly. And I can't afford to keep paying $250 an hour to maintain proficiency and to stay current, and the only way to do that is get a job. So you need to get a job pretty quick.
And I remember talking to you that there's that worry that the further you go from when you got all your ratings, you're getting more and more.
Especially when you meet a bunch of people who went to your school and a year has gone by and they work at Les Schwab Tires and they spent $80,000 and they haven't flown in a year because they can't afford it anymore.
Right.
You know, and you see those and you meet these people throughout the time, the couple of years that you spend, like, getting all your ratings and licenses and everything, and you see these stories. So, yeah, you're legitimately concerned that that could happen to you. Like, I'm going to spend all this money, then I'm not going to get a job, and then I'm not going to be able to continue to fly because it's too expensive.
And there are ways you can get cheaper time, and we're not going to talk about the ethics of people making you pay to do work. That's another discussion.
You can ferry aircraft, you know, and you can pay. But even in...
And then the traffic patrol at the one place where you could pay half
students.
The rate.
Yeah, but you're still paying a lot, and you're not really getting training. You're flying straight level, and you're flying the aircraft, and you are getting it at a reduced rate, but to what advantage? Like, if you already have a commercial license, you're not doing, like, autos, you're not doing a bunch of approaches, you're not landing off airport, you're not doing things that would keep your skills up. You're just, like, flying around the traffic thing, you know? It's like, so you are flying, but... And you're still paying, you know, you're still paying $150 an hour. It's not cheap.
Yeah, that's, like I said, I'm not going to talk about the ethics of it, because I think, like I told you, when I started flying, Horizon Airlines charged their co-pilots $10 an hour to fly, and that actually got shut down. That was viewed as not...
there are all kinds of creative ways to keep flying, you know? But it's still, even with creative ways, it's expensive to continue to fly. The only way to maintain it is to get a job. You need a job. Even if you're working for free, or you're working for minimum wage, or... What matters is that you're not paying $250 an hour to operate that aircraft, and you're building time to get to the point where you're insurable. That's the real problem. You need to be insurable. And at 200 hours, the only person that can insure you is the school you went to, and no one else will even consider giving you a job.
When you got it, I mean, you were looking at jobs all over the country.
Yeah, so I get this interview. you know, I fully expect them to hire me because, in my opinion, I did a good job. You know, I worked hard. I got all my ratings. I showed up on time. I did everything. You know, I finished their program, had a good attitude.
Gave them $80,000.
Gave them a bunch of money, and there was this expectation that I was going to get a job, and it didn't happen right away, you know, and I taught some lessons for them. They're like, oh, yeah, we're going to get another group of students, and you know, you're welcome to apply again. You did a great job, you know, but it was basically like, you know, there isn't a job for you right now, and, you know, and that's, and it, there wasn't, like, a big reason for it or anything. It wasn't like, oh, you didn't do this, or you could have done this better. It wasn't anything like that. It was just like, you know, you're welcome to apply again. We don't have a spot for you right now. That's it, you know, and it's like, well, okay, well, that's my only avenue to continue. So it's hard not to be like pissed off, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, but the thing is that the way I look at it later, after, you know, with some perspective, is that what school actually, if you go to any other school, what school guarantees you a job? You get a degree anywhere. They're not giving you a job. And so there, I kind of got caught in this expectation of, because of the way the industry kind of works, is that you have to get a job from that school. It's, you know, they're somehow obligated to give you a job because you spent your money there. And a lot of people feel that way, and I felt that way too. But looking back on it, I'm like, you know, they didn't really, you know, I paid them to get my license and my ratings, and they taught me how to fly a helicopter. That was the obligation.
That's what they did, what they were supposed to
do. They did what they were supposed to do, and yeah, it would have been really great. It would have been a lot easier, and not getting a job there could have been the end of me flying. And for a lot of people, it is when they don't get a job there, because the alternatives are difficult, and you have to be creative, and you have to be very flexible, and you have to be willing to, like, move to a place like South Carolina or Florida and work for very low wages, and you have to find someone who doesn't know you, who you didn't train with and never flew with, to give you an opportunity to fly their aircraft. And, like, you know, an R-44 costs $400,000. They don't know you from anyone else. They don't know anything about you.
Right, but it hire you, and this is, I think, ties in that first job when you've got 300 hours, it's probably not going to be the best paying. They're probably not going to treat you the best.
Yeah. It's not that I want to. I certainly was worked hard. Like, we worked a lot, but
it's your first job you actually got.
They didn't treat me poorly. He did everything that, you know, everything that he said was going to happen happened, and he wasn't lying to me. But he paid me minimum wage,
right?
Know? And in South Carolina, minimum wage is, you know, $7 an hour,
$7.30
an hour. You know, I lived off my credit card. I couldn't even. I moved out there and worked for nothing. And
but there weren't any other options.
There were no other options, and that option actually was very lucky. That, I mean, so what I did was I basically made like a spreadsheet of every person who operates a Robinson helicopter that I could find on the internet or otherwise. Like I started with the West Coast because I wanted to be on the West Coast, and I made a list of everybody: Oregon, Washington, California, Idaho, Utah. I mean, every place within, you know, several days drive. All their chief pilots, telephone numbers, addresses.
Talk to people.
I made up resumes, got some nice clothes, and was like, no, this isn't going to be the end of me. You know, like, I spent all this money. Like, I'm getting a job flying a helicopter. And I went to school after school, and it's like, well, you know, we trained a bunch of people, and we have this whole group of people that we can't give jobs to. And so, you know, why would we hire someone who didn't go to school here and didn't fly here? You know,
right.
So it's really depressing. You know, like, you go, you show up, and, you know, some of them, you know, you drive all the way out there and you spend a few minutes talking to them. Sometimes the guys are really cool and they take you around and spend some time talking to you, and they feel bad about it because they know how it is. And you quickly find out that there are people do that all the time, and people show up at these places all the time looking for jobs and they can't offer them to them. And that reality really starts to sink in that, like, wow, if I don't get a job at that school, like, I'm really in trouble here, you know?
And it's funny because I think that's the expectation. Everybody goes to fixed wing or rotorcraft, that they'll get a CFI job at that school. And the point you're making, I think, that is good.
There's no way they can hire everyone.
That school is not obligated to hire you, and they can't hire everyone.
Yeah, the math just doesn't add up.
And I did all my stuff at a really small little flight school at Cottage Grove, and I had no expectation of getting hired there, which might have helped me because I didn't even bother trying.
Well, the helicopter industry is really difficult because there literally are no jobs for a 200-hour pilot except teaching. And the only school that's going to hire you is the one that trained you. There's no way someone else... I mean, it is... It's not completely unheard of, but it's super rare for someone to do it.
And there are no right seat jobs that, you know, and you're looking around.
There aren't very few. There are a few other ways that take a long time. You can get a hazmat cert, and you can drive a truck fueling ag helicopters, right? There's a handful of ag companies that... So you can get your license and go and maybe not even get a CFI, just get your private and your commercial. Then you can get, you know, you can get endorsed to drive a truck, and then you can drive a fuel truck around, and you can hope that you're going to help ferry an aircraft once in a while, and you're going to work long hours, and you're going to drive around in fields, and you're going to mix chemicals, and you're going to do things working for an ag company, hoping that, you know, when they move it from the trailer over to the hangar, or when they take it from one field to the next, that they're going to let you fly. Because you're not going to do the ag work because you don't have the experience and you're not safe and you're not insurable. Now, but you are, they could possibly let you with another pilot in there fly from here to there, and be a 0.5 here, an hour here.
Now, something I've thought of, and I've tried to point this out to people when I talk to them, is that they can start that kind of job before they get all their ratings together. Because everybody focuses on getting the ratings, which is good.
Yeah, if you can get a job at the airport fueling
before you get all your ratings.
You know, you can get, like, most of these schools have shops, you know, and if you want to work as an A&P apprentice and sweep floors and you want to turn wrenches, and a lot of people have done that, you know, and get yourself involved there so that when you do finish your ratings, like, hey, you're already an employee, and you can, like, maybe we can give you a little bit of flying or whatever. But
well, maybe a leg up.
Mm-hmm. And some people, like, I have a good friend of mine who's kind of on the same path, and he decided partway through that it was going to be really difficult for him to get the job, and he got his A&P. And so he got his A&P with a CFI, and he did a lot of the flying that he's gotten to do has been maintenance run-ups and maintenance flights, and, you know, every time you work on it, you got to fly at a certain amount of time for depending on what you do with it. So he spent a whole lot of time turning wrenches, and he's got about half the flight time I have, but he's still making it. I mean, he's getting there.
And he's got the A&P to fall back on, which is always, wrenching's always a nice steady income.
Yeah, but it's the problem with the A&P situation is there's always a shortage of A&Ps. They always need A&Ps. There's never a shortage of pilots, so they always want... As soon as you tell them that you're an A&P, you're going to be turning wrenches and you're not going to be
flying. I have a friend who actually cut up his A&P license because every time that he wouldn't fly. They're always like, no, we really need you to fix this plane.
But if the door is totally shut and you want the door to be open,
yep,
that is a way to open the door.
And it's also a way to stay in the industry and make a decent living.
Yeah, you make more money.
Yeah.
And there's always a job.
Usually a better schedule, too. So back to kind of your past. So you flew those tours in South Carolina.
Yeah. So I got very lucky. I mean, I was super persistent. I went to a bunch of different places. I actually, you know, I had a situation where I thought I was going to work as a CFI up in Washington at Harvey Field. And I went there. I kind of interviewed with them. I taught some ground for them. They weren't real busy. Most of what they do is fixed wing. And they had Switzers. I hadn't flown a Switzer. And they wanted me to have like 20 hours in the Switzer. So that, because it's different than the Robinson, you know, it's got a manual, doesn't have a governor, has a manual throttle, has a few other things, it autos a little differently, it's just got some different, you know, different characteristics.
Different crates,
yeah. And they're not going to let you teach in it until you get some time in it at least, so they're like, get some time in it, if you can bring some students in, you can work here, you know, so I had this, like, okay, I can move up to Everett, basically, or Snohomish. Move up to Snohomish, and I can basically... work for nothing, and if I can get a bunch of students in here, I can at least teach some ground, and I can stay involved with helicopters, but how am I going to survive doing this because I'm out of money and I need a real job? And I'm like, it was this prospect of like, okay, well, it's sort of an opportunity, but they're like, you can use our helicopter, you know, once you've spent money here and gotten yourself up to speed with this, you know.
And once you pay us your first year's salary...
But you need to bring in students because we have a lot of fixed wing students, but we don't have a lot of helicopter students. And if you can get students in here and you can, you know, you can use our classrooms and you can use our stuff and, you know, you can do this, you know, but it was like, there's no guarantee of a wage. It was like, we'll pay you if you have a student. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. I couldn't really afford to do it. And I was like, I went up there and I was staying in their little apartments and I was like, okay, well, I guess I can do this until I run out of money, and then I'll have to go get a job somewhere else. And so that was my plan. And, you know, that's all I had.
Yeah.
And at least it was in the Northwest, and I was like, okay,
whatever. And it was still, it's going to keep you current.
But at that same time, I had been, like, sending out resumes to just crazy vertical reference. You know, it was one of the helicopter, you know, websites that has all kinds of job postings and all stuff and people on there and just helicopters and, you know, sending out, calling people, you know, just trying everything to find a job. And while I was there, a guy from South Carolina called me, and he basically said, I'm starting a R44 tour company in South Carolina. And, you know, I need pilots out here. He's like, can you be in West Virginia in like 4 days for a flight interview? And he basically said, I'm going to pay you minimum wage, and, you know, you're going to fly tours of the beach. You know, if you come out to West Virginia, I'll set up a flight interview with you. If you can fly and you can be in South Carolina a week after that.
You know. And didn't he also say it was something along the lines of you're going to fly tours and in between you're going to watch the helicopter? And
well, we loaded. I mean, it was an interesting thing. So what I, you know, later found out, so this guy had a lot of money, started a brand new helicopter company, hired 12 people, bought four helicopters, put these pads in. Myrtle Beach is a super busy summer place. There's a huge amount of people that come there. There was already an established helicopter company there that was doing a really large volume of tours. He modeled his company after that company, 5-minute to 30-minute tours, making it really cheap, you know, so that you can get big numbers of people and fly all day. And you know, he had a lot of money, and he was able to advertise and build a building and buy all these helicopters and bring all these people out. But he really didn't have a lot of experience in aviation. He didn't know that he shouldn't be hiring 200-hour pilots to fly tours. Sure, it's legal, but no one does it, you know. And he didn't. I got super lucky because he didn't know. You know, he's like, oh, this guy's got a commercial helicopter's license and he's got a nice resume, and he called me a bunch of times and he's persistent. You know,
yeah.
So I went out there, which is completely unheard of, and started flying tours at like 240 hours, and I was terrified. I was like, it was windy, it was max gross, it was hot. He had this tight little spot to land in. I was like, the first tour, I was so nervous. I was like, I didn't even talk to the people. You know, I'm like, I'm like giving a tour and I'm like terrified. You know? I mean, I didn't have the experience to do it.
Right.
I mean, I came straight from a flight school. I'd never worked as a CFI.
But you learned a lot the first month, I bet.
Oh, I learned a lot on the first day. Yeah. So, and I mean, you know, I was fresh out of flight school, so I had the skills to fly. My flight interview went really well. I mean, we just did a bunch of commercial maneuvers, which I just had been doing every day for, you know, the last year and a half. So I was like, yeah, sweet. I was pretty sharp on the Robinson, but I hadn't ever flown one full of people where I was at max gross before, because it was just me and my instructor.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
It's a different and project, right?
I hadn't flown one where the guy's like, I need you to be back here in 5 minutes on the dot. So now suddenly, instead of doing like a nice mellow approach into this little spot, you're like flying in there, flaring it off and landing. And you're like, oh, that was 5 minutes and 5 seconds. And the guy's like, you know, and there was a lot of differences, you know, like he was about making money and he wanted, you know, he had a 5 minute, a 10 minute, a 15 minute, a 20 minute tour, and skids up, skids down. That thing was back in under 5 minutes and under 10 minutes and under, and like it was, you know, fly at 110 knots, haul ass in here safely as you can, and land the thing. Don't sit there and, like, take a long time to set it down and take a nice, you know, in school you're like, okay, set it up at 60 knots, come in a nice, you know, 5 degrees. And, you know, it was like barrel in here and flare it off and land it and like, get the people out and put some more people in, you know, hot loading people, doing all the stuff that you don't do in school. And there's a lot to learn.
And
yeah.
Did that for 6 months.
Yeah.
And came out of that probably a lot better pilot.
I left there with 500 hours, and which is enough to get other jobs. And I learned a ton. And, yeah, it was interesting, for sure. The very next year, he upped his minimums 500. Because now he knows. Because he had problems. You know, he hired a bunch of people. Some of them couldn't hack it. Some of them, out of 12 people that he hired there, there were 6 left at the end of the season. Partly because he was a difficult person, and partly because it was lot to handle to a $200 helicopter pilot.
And he was hiring a lot of those because he could get them cheap.
Yeah, he could get them cheap. Who wants to come work for $7 an hour, right? Like, if you have 1,000 hours, you're not going to come and work for $7 an hour.
And you've got $80,000 in loans to pay
off. Yeah, so he was learning. We were all learning. Thankfully, it was safe. It ended up safe, you know, and, like, no one got hurt and no one had any problems. I mean, he did a lot to, he hired people to come in and do check flights with us and, you know, and he had people, he did training with us. He actually spent a lot of money training us because I think he realized right away that, like, wow, these people really don't have the experience to do this. And, and then he hired someone to come out and fly with us and we did, and he paid for it. And I learned a lot for sure.
That's awesome. And then the Florida job is more flight seeing.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing. But, you know, I was an established guy who had been around for a long time. He had been operating a tour company, two locations in the Orlando area, doing tours of the Disney theme parks. He had an established business that had been there. You know, he wasn't hiring 200-hour people. I mean,
his
minimum was 500, and he'd like to see more like 7 or 8, you know.
And you had a friend who went down there.
So one of the guys I worked with, so the Myrtle Beach job was seasonal. It was, you know, Labor Day. You know, it's a beach town that gets cool in the wintertime, no one's around. So it's all
summer's over. People are at school.
When kids go back to school, that town dies. So it was a seasonal job. Freddie, my boss, said, "You're welcome to come back. You did a good job this season. Would love to have you back next year." So I was like, okay. So I didn't have anything else, and I went home, back to Oregon, drove all the way back. You know, stopped at some helicopter companies.
I remember talking to you somewhere.
Yeah, I went to a bunch of helicopter companies. I made a list on my way back, like, you know. I might as well stop at all the places I can on the way back. And I took an old carpentry. I went to an old company that I used to work for years ago in Portland, and I paid my union dues up and got my tools together, bought some boots, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to spend the winter, like, be a carpenter again and make some money because I just starved to death all summer long. And now I have credit card debt, you know?
Starved to death being a professional helicopter pilot.
Yeah, and so, but I was like, I was super happy. I got my first job. I have 500 hours now, and, like, I was more employable, and I was at a point where I could get other jobs.
You're more, but you actually are a better pilot.
Yeah, way better. I learned so much there. It was incredible. And so then I got super lucky. I went home, and one of the guys that I worked with in South Carolina, he was, like, my partner. We were kind of partnered up. We spent part of the day loading and part of the day flying, so it was, like, there was three helicopters usually running at once, and there were six of us on shift, and one person would load, one person would fly, and, like, you know, fly a tank off and then, like, switch up, you know, load the people. We have golf carts, you bring them out in the golf cart, load them up, and it's kind of a fast thing. You know, a lot of tours are, like, 10 minutes long, 15 minutes long, so you're constantly loading people and, you know, keeping people away from the tail rudder and that kind of stuff, so you spent a lot of time doing that. Anyway, the guy that I worked with there, the guy I was partnered up with, he was from Florida and had done his training in Florida and knew people in the Florida aviation community. He went back home to Florida and was able to get a job flying tours in Florida. And so I got home maybe a month after I was home, just getting ready to start my job. He calls me up, "Hey, I got a spot for you at this place I'm at in Orlando. If you can come out to Orlando, you can fly tours, you know?" And so he's like, "You know, we got to cover 7 days. It'd be just you and me working. So, you know, I'd do 4 and you could do 3 and that would get you, keep you flying.
Stay current."
And I'm like, at that point I was like, I don't have any money. I just committed to this job. Like, he was good enough to, like, give me a job after I haven't worked here for a bunch of years. You know, I just showed up out of the blue and he was like, okay, we'll put you to work. And, so I was like, I don't know if I can do it, you know? And I was like, I already have credit card debt. I've already spent all this money. I really just wanted to save some money over the winter and, like, get back on track and then worry about it the following season. So I talked to my parents about it a little bit, and I was like, yeah, you know, I'd still like to fly. And I, like, told my mom about it, and my mom's like, oh, yeah, you gotta do it. You don't want to be a carpenter anymore. You don't want to do
that. Plus, you've already sunk so much in.
And I'm like, well, I don't have the money. And my mom's like, well, what will it cost you to move to Florida and do, you know? I'm like, you know, a couple thousand bucks. I got to get an apartment. I got to have gas to get out there and everything. So my mom's like, here you go.
Cool.
Here's $2,000. Go out there and just see how it works. And I'm like, okay. So get further into debt and go to Orlando.
Excuse me.
And I get there, and the guy was a really reasonable person. He was paying me pretty well. I made $40,000 working there in the first year
that
I was there, $41,000 plus my tips. He had a great helicopter. He was a good person to work for. It actually really worked out. And the crazy part is, so I go there for what I think is going to be 3 days a week. I'm there for a month, and the guy who helped me get the job gets fired. And I get the full-time job.
Now you're the only guy.
I mean, like, I was there for a month, and I had the full-time job. And then he didn't hire anyone else. And I just, and then they had a guy just filled in, and I worked as much as I wanted. So
for, and that was a year and a half you were there.
I was there for a year and a half. Guy was super good to me. I learned a ton. I got to, he bought some new aircraft in California. I got to ferry a brand new helicopter from LA all the way back to Florida. Huh. He sold his other helicopter. I got to fly it to Texas with a guy. I got to give BFRs because I was the only CFI. I give flight reviews to all his employees. Like, I did golf ball drop because he was super into golfing. He had another owner that...
What's a golf ball drop?
Yeah, it's like a charity events and stuff. So he's a big golfer. What they do is they sell golf balls for a certain amount of money. They have them all numbered. You go out to a big event at a golf course. You hover over it and pour golf balls out and try to get them in the hole. And then whoever gets their numbered ball in the hole, you know, like, wins something. You know? So we do those all the time. It's fun. You know, you fly out to a golf course. There's all these people having a big party and go out with a helicopter and, you know... dump balls out of it, you know, try to get them in. It's actually pretty challenging because you have all this rotor wash and stuff, you know, you're like 50 foot above the hole and you're like trying to dump a ball out and it's like flying all, you're like a little bit, you know, you're kind of trying to get a real good out of ground effect hover and pour balls into it.
It's funny, but at CFI is kind of the normal route that everybody goes fixed wing rotorcraft. But there are all these other ways. I flew skydivers. Mm-hmm. And it just thinking about the golf ball drops made me think of, we'd do these demo flights where you'd fly skydiver to some big county fair and you'd drop, you know, dump the jumpers out at a certain time, you'd circle out and they'd want them to land and just do all these little weird things that they don't hammer home the basics in terms of knowledge, in terms of FARs and whatnot, but they I think your physical flying skills get better if you're doing weird shit.
Yeah.
So that job directly led to you getting this job here in Vegas, flying the A-Star.
Yeah. I mean, I think the real getting jobs, especially in the helicopter aviation, all comes down to people and who you know and the connections. And if I was going to start again, the advice I would give to someone, or if I was talking to someone who's going to start, from the first day that you start, you know, make friends, talk to people, like... you network as much as you can, because that's how you're going to get a job. All the jobs I've got, like this job I got at Sundance, it was totally a friend. Like, it was somebody that, and like, they get an extreme amount of resumes all the time that go in the dumpster. Like, they can't even read the amount that they get. They get every CFI in the country wants to come fly tours of the Grand Canyon because they're one of the only, these companies are, and the few in Alaska are the only ones that will hire you at 1,000 hours and turbine transition you into an A-Star. And everybody wants to fly an A-Star because they use it for heli skiing, they use it for utility work, they use them for EMS. And so it's super valuable to fly that aircraft. It's super expensive to fly it. And no one wants to transition you and pay it except companies like this, you know? And so everybody at every little flight school in the whole country, this is on their list, and Alaska is on their list.
Right.
You know, and there's not enough jobs for those people.
So if you know someone who's willing to put your resume in front of the chief pilot.
Yeah, and you never know who it's going to be, right? You went to school with somebody, and for whatever reason, they know somebody, and that's how it ends up working. Some guys that I work with in South Carolina went to flight school in Los Angeles. A bunch of the people from L.A., Chino area, all ended up with jobs out here. He knew a bunch of people here. I knew him. We worked together. Boom. I get it. You know, when I have my 1,000 hours and the jobs come up, I get a job. And, you know, somebody else who's been out here 4 times with his resume and a suit and tie and has been trying to get a job here and hasn't been able to get one, suddenly you're just, like, in front of the line and you're in there and you're doing a flight interview. Like, it's just, that's how it works.
Well, but the persistence does help. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you got lucky with the job.
Well, you have to be competent, but you have to get all your ratings and licenses. You have to be just having a friend isn't going to help you at all if you don't do all the other steps.
And you have to be ready to go. You have to be ready to move across the country.
Yeah,
you got to keep sending the resumes out. It's a pain in the ass, but it.
It took me, you know, when I finished school, I didn't just get that job in South Carolina right away. It took me 6 months.
Right.
Of spending money and.
continuing to fly and trying to keep myself current. Yeah. And before I went to South Carolina, I hadn't been flying an R-44 at all. I went into Seattle and paid $400 an hour to go get current in a R-44 before I went out there, because I'd been flying this Schweitzer and I did all my training in R-22. I mean, it's huge money. Like, I spent a fortune and a lot of time.
That's also why it's almost everyone I've talked to, literally everyone, they talk about the first job and they say, I got lucky. And my argument is that they didn't get lucky because they didn't just sit back on the sofa and wait for the job to come to them. They went out and put themselves out there, and then they got the job. It's like the people who throw themselves in the way of the train, they're the ones who catch that luck.
Yeah, you're not going to...
Or willing to make
if you want to stay wherever you're from, you know? Like, I'm pretty fond of the Northwest and the West Coast. I like to climb. I like mountains. There's not a lot of those in Florida and South Carolina. It's a big adjustment lifestyle-wise. Not something I necessarily really wanted to do, but it became pretty apparent pretty quickly that if I was persistent with, oh, I want to be in Oregon, or oh, I want to be in Washington or California, it wasn't going to happen,
right?
And if you are limiting yourself to, like, I'm going to just be in this area and I'm only going to work for this amount of money, that's not going to happen.
You're just not going to get a job.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
At that point, you have no chips. Like, you're not, there's no bargaining. Like, it's like you're begging for a job.
It's funny. I had a guy come up to Anchorage, and we just sat down and had coffee. We were talking about jobs to get in Anchorage. And I was like, this company's good. This one, maybe not so good. And I said, you might, this one's a little bit better. And he looked at me and he's like, dude, I have 350 hours. And I was like, oh, right. He's like, no, I said, I have 352 hours. I was like, right, take whichever job I can get offered first.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an eye-opener. Because, he didn't have, you have no cards at that minimal experience.
No, and if you don't fly, you quickly lose currency.
Yeah.
And you become less and less marketable. Like, when did you finish your CFI? Oh, a year ago. How long has it been? How much have you flown in the last 30 days, 90 days? Like, that's the first thing they ask you. Are you current?
Currency's important.
Yeah, and it's expensive.
Yeah.
$250 an hour to go get an hour of flight time, and an hour looks like nothing. Like,
yeah.
Oh, you flew an hour in the last month, like, and it cost me $250, you know? Like,
yeah. What was, back to the job you have now, what was the transition to the A-Star from the 44 Light?
I think in terms of... there was a lot of adjustment, not just to an A-Star, but from a Part 91 company to a Part 135 company, right? Like,
right.
You're talking about a company that has two people, family ran, there's not a lot of rules, not a lot of paperwork, you know, there's the typical drug testing, that type of thing, and you,
right.
know,
you, have, to follow, requirements.
You have to follow the FAA rules, you know?
Right.
The pretty simple stuff that you learn in school. You know, you're still PIC and you're still responsible for not breaking laws in Part 91 company.
Right.
But in a Part 135 company, there's a whole another layer of rules and regulations and duty tracking and how many hours I can work in a calendar, you know, quarter or year.
Yep.
Like, there's a lot of more layers of stuff.
And you've got the FARs now and the ops manual, the ops specs that they're operating under.
Yeah, so you come in, you know, working for a small company that's pretty simple. I'm doing very small tours that are pretty straightforward. And you spend 2 weeks training, and it's like having a fire hose in your mouth. Like, there's so much stuff. Like, you're learning a brand new aircraft, turbine transition. You're doing, check rides. You're working in a special flight rules area because you're working in a national park. You're operating out of Bravo airspace at McCarran. There's specific ways in and out. There's radar gates. There's all these. It's much more complex than working at a Part 91 company. And it happens fast, you know. They cost them a lot to train you. They give you a couple weeks to bring it all together. And you only get 5 hours in the aircraft before you take a check ride in it.
Right.
It's A-Star is really difficult at slow speed and hover to pick up and set down compared to an R-44. And so there's a lot to learn in 5 hours, and they have a fairly high rate of failure.
Huh.
Like when they were doing about four people in a class. This time they did eight because they're so far behind, like and needed people. But
right.
About half of the two classes before mine, about half the people who were hired there were let go in training.
Wow.
And so, and mainly because it's a ton of information in a short amount of time, and there's a lot of stress to get it done, right? People move all the way out here. They quit their job, which somebody else takes.
Right.
So they can't go back to it. And there's a lot of pressure to make it happen.
And it's partly the knowledge base side, but it's also flying the helicopter, so also how current you are on flying, probably.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of CFIs come into the... So your typical person gets us, you know, gets finished with between 200 and 250 hours as a CFI or double I, right? Then you often teach instruments, you know, or for a lot of times they'll start you on instruments because it's safer, right? You're just doing procedures, you're straight and level flying, you're not doing a bunch of autos and stuff, you know, you're kind of getting comfortable and getting used to teaching people doing something that's relatively safe. You know, got a guy in a hood and you're basically a safety pilot and making sure that he's following the procedures. He's not doing a bunch of emergency stuff, so.
Right.
And then you spend the next 800 hours sitting in the left seat and you're demoing stuff and flying sometimes, but the majority of the time is hands-on. He's flying and you're maybe bumping the controls a little bit and you're saying, like, don't do this and you should do it like this. And you're explaining how to do things and you're teaching them, but you're not doing all the flying. Very little of the flying you're actually doing. So less than half of your time is you actually flying. It's them flying.
And you monitoring. So do you think your background with your initial two jobs being air tours was probably a good, you know,
base of knowledge and skill? I mean, it certainly helped me to have my entire 1,000 hours, you know, I had 1,100 or almost 1,200 hours when I got here, was all me flying. You know, it wasn't someone else flying.
And so, flying tours, which is what you're doing now, too. So it's some mm-hmm. dealing with the public. And
I definitely struggled with flying the A-Star and getting to a commercial level in 5 hours. Like, everybody does. I mean, yeah. You're stressed. I mean, you fly it, like, you basically go on three flights, and then you're taking a check ride.
And you've got a lot of wind and altitude issues here, too.
Yeah, and it's super windy here, and it's hot, and they're loading the helicopter up, and you know, you think you're like, oh, I'm in this new helicopter that has this big turbine engine and has 700 horsepower, and I'm going to have all this power. When you're doing your training, you're like in there with one guy, and it does have a ton of power. Yeah, but then you do your first tour, and they throw six people in there,
and
it's 4 pounds under max gross weight, and it's 90 degrees outside. So it's just like an R-22, because you pick it up, and you're, like, pulling into the transitory when you're in a hover, and you're like, whoa, you know?
I thought I was in a turbine. Yeah. What the hell?
So, and then you're flying from 2,000 feet at McCarran, you know, to 5,000 feet at the Grand Canyon, and you're landing off airport.
Huh.
So, like, it's...
In yeah. 5 hours of training, that's aggressive, it seems like. I mean, that's good.
Well, it's expensive.
Exactly, yeah. $1,600
an hour. $1,600 an hour to operate it. So, like, they're not going to... They figure there's a ton of applicants, and there's going to be some that can do it in that amount of time, and that's going to save us some money.
What do you see for you now? Obviously, you just started this job. You're not going to go anywhere real soon.
I'm, like, 2 months into it.
Yeah, so you're... Looking down the road, I mean, you're in this first turbine, and if you just sit here and get 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 hours, you can probably pick and choose a lot more. So what kind of jobs do you think are beyond this? You know, what kind of good helicopter jobs?
To me, I think it's about schedule. Like, I thought that I wanted to be, like, a helisky pilot, you know, like, because I used to be, you know, into mountain guiding.
Or Antarctica.
And I grew up in the mountains, and I love the mountains, and that, you know, part of why I wanted to fly was because I wanted to be in the mountains and fly in the mountains. But I think, you know, I'm 39 years old and I'm like, the heli-ski jobs are seasonal and they don't pay that well. And then, you know, the flying's pretty dangerous and it's hit and miss and it gets shut down by weather all the time. And then after the season's over, you got to find out how you're going to fill in the rest of the year and on and on. It reminds me of a lot of other jobs I've done, and I'm like, that seems like a very similar story to what I've already been living and trying to get away from a little bit. And so, although it's sort of a fantasy of mine to do that, I'm not sure that I'm going to do it. But
ride this job as long as you enjoy it.
Yeah,
I
think about EMS because of the schedule. You know, week on, week off, I can go climb, I can make a decent living, I got a great schedule, there's EMS all over the country, you can probably live somewhere on the West Coast in a decent place that you wouldn't mind living, you know, be closer to my family, that sort of stuff.
Here's something interesting. EMS has always, when I, you know, for the last 10 years, kind of poked at helicopters. And the EMS jobs are kind of the top of the heap job, it always seemed like. And
not,
what are you
not
seeing?
Money. Not definitely not money. You can make a lot more money.
Like doing others. But it's a but
utility
it's
work pays.
But it's an easy schedule. It's a nice schedule, and you're home at night.
So utility is another job I thought, like, oh, and I still think about, and I have a couple friends who are doing it, and they're making a lot of money. And they're making a lot of money because it's a dangerous job.
And they're gone a lot.
And they're gone a lot. And they're living out of a hotel, and they're traveling around. You know, it's just a matter of, do you want to live in, you know, out of a Motel 6 in Missouri while you're doing power line patrol, you know? Like, not really, you know?
Cool. Well, let's start wrapping this up. We need to go to dinner. Dylan's got a guide again tomorrow, and I've got to catch a flight up and do some float flying tomorrow. You've got air tours to fly.
We do.
Has it been worth it?
It has. I mean, I enjoy it. I'm happy to be doing it, for sure. Financially, certainly not yet, of course. Yeah. Like, you know, right now I'm financially not, for sure, but, like, I think eventually it will. I think eventually it'll be a good schedule, and it's close now. I'm at the point now where, like you said, like, you've made it, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's up to you to screw it up at this point, you know? Like I have, I'm a 135 pilot. I fly a turbine helicopter, and I'm flying a helicopter that, you know, you get very valuable hours out of it.
Right.
And there's a lot of opportunities at the next level, you know?
And you're living back out west, and you go mountain biking.
And I'm back home, you know? I mean, I'm in Las Vegas, but at least I'm, like, on the right side of the country, and there's mountains and climbing. It certainly didn't feel like it, you know, a year ago in Florida when it was super hot and humid, and I was away from my girlfriend, family, friends, and I was making, you know, not very much money.
Did you think when you started it would be this...
I researched it. I looked into it, and you read all this stuff. You know, if you spend any time really looking into it, which I did, you know, you hear all the stories. You heard how hard it is. I mean, if you spent any time at all, but you tend to believe that, oh, it's not going to be me. You know, I'm going to work really hard. And I'm smart. Like I'm going to be better than those guys. But then, you know, I'm going to. You know, everyone, I mean, you have to have some kind of confidence and
right.
belief in yourself that you're going to, and that you're a hardworking person and that you're smart enough and confident enough to do these things. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able
you
to
wouldn't
do it.
Start it. Well,
you wouldn't start it.
It did work. But if somebody was starting out, what I'm guessing you'd probably tell them to expect it to be hard and to make some sacrifices.
Expect like 5 years and 100 grand. Like,
yeah.
If you don't have 5 years and 100 grand, go do something else.
And be willing to move wherever you need to go.
If you don't have financial support from you or your family, or you aren't willing to work really hard, it's hard. There's a lot of check rides. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of studying. Like,
yeah.
A ton of studying. Instrument ratings are not easy to get. Like,
that's a pain in the ass.
Double, you know, CFI stuff. I mean, all of it is a lot of work. It's not not a lot. A lot of it's not flying.
135 ground school, it doesn't really end.
You're constantly being check rides all the time, and you can't hide in a check ride. Either you're competent or you're not. Either you know the information or you're not. Like, it's a one-on-one with somebody who knows a lot and who's asking you tough questions, and, like, you can't say, I don't know, you know?
Right.
Like, or you fail. And then,
or you can say, I don't know, but then it doesn't go well.
It doesn't go well. So there's a lot of studying. There's a lot of time, to get to the point where you're making, you know, a decent living, you know, a living that you could support yourself with. You're looking at 4 or 5 years, and you're looking at probably spending minimum of 70,000, probably more like 80,000 to 100,000, depending on how long it took you, where you went to school. You know, California is a lot more expensive than Oregon, you know, like,
right,
and just whatever, you know, and people will tell you that you can do it a lot cheaper, and some people do,
but not many
cheaper, but not many, and the likelihood is low.
That's what I've seen.
It costs a lot of money.
And cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Should we...
If you take out loans for that, like, you are so screwed. Like, if you borrow $80,000 and you finish school and make minimum wage, that is not...
You just can't pay out the interest.
It's not going to happen.
The numbers, the math doesn't add up.
I mean, you're talking, you know, before you'd ever be making enough money to, like, start paying that back, you're probably talking 7 or 8 years down the road. Yeah. Meanwhile, you're, like, accruing tons of interest and probably not even being able to make the minimum payment on it, you know?
And most helicopter jobs top out in that 90 to 100 grand year at the top end. I mean, I know there's some contract jobs you
can't
get
make more than
lot.
That. You know, I mean, certainly people do make more than that. You know, like they do corporate transport.
And they
go to like the Middle East and make, you know, a ton of money.
I'll say the military contract guys or the Ericsson Sky Crane, I think.
And some of the utility guys that are doing like that pretty high risk, like, you know, power lines, setting power lines and stuff like that, and working on live power lines with people and stuff, those guys are making a lot of money.
Cool, and they should.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not for everyone.
Right.
And not everyone's got those skills, even, you know, and not everyone should be doing that, you know.
And not everybody wants to.
But I mean, you're talking like an EMS job, you know, 70, 80 grand, you know, something like that.
Cool. Dylan, you ready to give up the paragliding and guiding and go fly helicopters?
No, I like sitting in them.
It's fun. Like they're fun to ride in, aren't they?
I like sitting in them, and I like getting out on the top of a mountain and skiing down.
That sounds pretty good.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.